Dirk Courtney did not speak, made no comment nor exclamation, asked no question until he was done. He spun the pistol, two turns, and the butt snapped into the palm of his hand. Two turns and snap. Two turns and snap. When Peter Bourtis finished, Dirk cocked the hammer of the pistol, and the click of the mechanism was unreasonably loud in the silent room. Hobday, my father, his wife, young Anders, and yourself, the only ones that know. And the Zulu. And the Zulu, Dirk agreed, and dry-fired the pistol. The hammer cracked against the pan. How many copies of the statement? One, lied Peter, in the iron safe of the general study. Dirk nodded and re-cocked the pistol. All right. If there is another copy, you have it, he said. But we don't lie to each other, do we, Peter? It was the first time he had used his given name. There was a familiarity and a threat in it, and Peter could only nod with a dryness in his throat. Again Dirk dry-fired the pistol and smiled. It was that warm and charming smile, that frank and friendly smile that Peter knew so well. We love each other too much for that, don't we? He kept smiling. That's why you came to tell me this, isn't it? Because we love each other? Peter said nothing, and Dirk went on, still smiling. And of course you are going to be a rich man, Peter, if you do as I ask. A very rich man. You will do as I ask, won't you, Peter? And Peter nodded again. Yes, of course, he blurted. I want you to make a phone call, said Dirk. If you speak through a handkerchief, it will sound as though it's long distance, and it will muffle your voice. Nobody will recognize it. Will you do that? Of course, Peter nodded. You will phone my father's house, speak either to him or his wife. I want you to pretend that you are the superintendent of Addington Hospital. And here is what you will tell them. Dirk Courtney sat in the darkened cab of the truck and listened to the rain as he reviewed his plans and preparations carefully. He did not like having to move in a hurry without time for careful planning. It was too easy to overlook some vital detail. He did not like to have to do this type of work himself. It was best to send another. He did not take personal risks, not any more, not unless there was no other way. Regrets and misgivings were vain and wasted the moments which still remained before action. He turned all his attention back to his planning. They would use the rolls, and there would be three of them, the general and his Jewish whore and that arrogant, scheming puppy, Anders. Dirk had picked the spot with care, and the farmyard truck was loaded with 50 sacks of horse feed, 3 tons of dead weight. It would give it irresistible momentum. Afterwards, he must do 2 things. Firstly, he must make sure of them. He had a length of lead piping wrapped in Hessian packing. It would crack a skull without breaking skin. Then he must take the general's keys. The key of the safe was on the bunch, and it was on his watch chain. The thought of plundering his father's dead body did not cause him even a tremor. His only concern was that the keys were retrievable, that there was no fire, and that the rolls was not submerged in the roaring torrent of the Baboonstroom. If that did happen, he must rely then on the general not having changed his habits of 20 years before. The spare key had been kept in the wine cellar then, on the rack above the champagne bottles. Dirk had discovered it there when he had used the cellar in a boyhood game, and he had taken the key twice for his own ends and returned it secretly. The general was an old dog, a creature of habit. It would still be there, Dirk was certain. All right, then, the safe. 2 keys. If neither was available, then it was an old safe, but he did not want to use force on it. He must hope for the keys. Anyway, he was content that he could open it one way or another. The statement was his, to be carefully burned. And that left Hobday, probably in one of the guest rooms, sedated, helpless. The lead pipe again, and then an overturned paraffin lamp. It was a big house of old, dry wooden beams and thick thatch. It would burn as a pyre, with Hobday lying in it like a Viking chieftain. That left only Peter Bourtis. Dirk glanced sideways at him. The situation was containable. It was no worse than 50 others he had survived. It needed only swift, direct action. He spoke encouragingly to Peter.
"Oh, don't worry," he said.
"After tonight, a new life awaits you. I'm going to take you with me along the paths of wealth and power, Peter. You'll never regret this night, I swear it to you." He squeezed Peter's upper arm, a comradely gesture in the darkness. Of course he had a copy of the statement, Dirk thought. But afterwards there would be time, plenty of time to find it, and to be rid of the pompous little prig. In a year or so, when the excitement had died down, another little accident, and it would all be over. "Have you got the pistol?" he asked. And Peter gulped nervously, clutching the bulky military model Smith Wesson with both hands between his knees. "You're not to use it," Dirk warned again, "except as the very last resort. We don't want bullet holes to explain. You do understand?"
"Yes, I understand."
"You are insurance, that's all. Final insurance." And out in the darkness, through the slanting arrows of rain, a light glowed and faded and grew again higher up the slope. "Here they come," said Dirk, and started the engine of the truck. Mark spun the wheel hard right and thrust the accelerator pedal flat against the floorboards, trying to ride off the collision and beat the great roaring vehicle to the threshold of the bridge. Behind him, Ruth Courtney screamed shrilly. But Mark thought he had made it. He thought for an instant that the sudden acceleration had forged the rolls ahead. But the truck slewed hard, swinging viciously, and he felt the crack of impact in every bone of his body. It struck at the level of the rear wheels of the rolls, and the big, heavy car snapped sideways, tearing his hands from the steering wheel and hurling Mark against the door. He felt bones break in his chest like dry twigs, and then the world turned end over end as the rolls cartwheeled. A shower of bright white sparks flamed like the tail of a meteor in the darkness as steel brushed murderously against steel. There was another jerk as the rolls crashed through the guardrail of the bridge, and then they were dropping free, plunging silently into the black space. In the rear seat, Ruth Courtney was still screaming, and the rolls struck, a glancing, shuddering blow, bounding off the rock wall of the gorge and leaping out into space once more. Mark was pressed against the side door, held there by the accelerating, dropping force of the plunging rolls. But at the next impact, the door burst open, and Mark was hurled like a stone from a slingshot out into the resounding, swirling darkness. He saw the burning headlights of the rolls spinning in a great vortex of blinding white below him, and the gorge rang with the iron echoes of steel on rock and the crazy bellowing roar of the Rolls-Royce engine jammed at full power. He seemed to fall forever through darkness, and then suddenly he struck with a force that drove the air from his lungs. The hard, unyielding impact convinced him for a moment that his body was crushed to boneless pulp on the rocky floor of the gorge, but then the cold, tumultuous torrent of racing water overwhelmed him. He had been thrown far enough to fall into the river itself. Clinging to his last shreds of consciousness, he fought for breath, fought to keep his head above the surface as the torrent swept him away. Glistening black boulders leapt like predators out of the dark, clawing at his legs, pummeling his injured chest, barging into him with numbing, bruising power in the flood. And icy water gushed down his straining throat, burning his lungs and making him choke and retch for each breath. He slid down a racing spill of white rapids, feeling skin stripped from his hip and shoulder at the contact of harsh rock, and then at the bottom he struck again, jammed solid between two monumental rocks. In the darkness they stood over him like gravestones. He was held in their jaws, and the water tore furiously at him, as though denied of its prey, trying to pluck him away. There was light, just enough to make out shapes and distances, and Mark marvelled at that with a brain jellied by pounding and starved of oxygen. Then he looked up, and through streaming eyes saw that the truck was parked on the threshold of the bridge high above the gorge. Its headlights struck the ironwork, and the light was broken up and diffused by the rain. It cast a vague, uncertain glow into the gorge. Added to this was a closer, more powerful light source. The smashed carapace of the Rolls-Royce lay at the foot of the cliff, half in the water, half upon the rocky ledge. It lay on its back, with all four wheels spiralling idly, but both headlights still burned fiercely, striking the uneven rock walls, providing a dramatic stage lighting. Mark looked around him, and saw that the current had swept him in under the cliff, and that a ledge of glistening black rock extended out over his head. He reached up with his right hand, and then cried out as his fingers touched the ledge, and bright agony flared in his wrist. Something was broken there, he realized, as he clung desperately to the slippery boulders and tried to force the fingers of his right hand to open or close. The torrent was too strong to resist much longer, and he felt himself starting to slide, dragging over the boulders, on the point of being swept away once more. He knew that less than 100 yards downstream the first waterfall plunged, frothing and thundering down the sheer side of the escarpment. He released his grip with the left hand and threw himself upwards with all his strength. His fingers caught on the sharp lip of the ledge above him, and his body swung like a pendulum, the hungry waters slashing at his knees, testing the strength of his grip, trying to drag him away, trying to break the hooked fingers, tearing the fingernails loose, so that droplets of blood squeezed out from under them. Slowly, achingly, Mark bent the arm at the elbow, lifting his knees, drawing his feet clear of the water and its murderous drag. He hung another moment, gathering what was left of his strength and resolve, and then with one last convulsive heave, he threw his right arm upwards and hooked his elbow over the ledge and followed it immediately with his left elbow. Another moment of rest, and then he wriggled painfully out on the ledge and lay face down. He thought he was blind now, or that the lights had been doused, but the darkness was in his head only. Slowly the darkness cleared, and he lifted his head. The thunder of the river drowned out all other sound. He could not hear the scrabble of loose stone and the slide of booted feet as Dirk Courtney came down the almost vertical pathway below the bridge. It did not surprise Mark that it was him. It seemed only natural that Dirk Courtney should be here, at the scene of disaster. He was dressed in hunting breeches and calf-length boots, a thick navy pea jacket, and a woolen cap pulled low over his face. He slid down the last 10 feet of the cliff, keeping his balance, light as a dancer on his feet, and he paused on the ledge beside the shattered rolls. Carefully he looked about him, flashing a lantern into the shadows and crevices. Mark flattened himself down on the rock, but he was beyond the range of the lantern beam. Dirk turned to the beam on the rolls, and Mark groaned with the shock of it. General Sean Courtney had been thrown halfway through the windscreen, and then the full weight of the machine had rolled onto his upper torso. His head was almost severed, and the thick white beard was sodden with bright blood that shone like rubies in the lantern light. Dirk Courtney stooped over him and felt for the carotid pulse in the throat. Despite the fearful mutilation, he must have detected some flutter of stubborn life there. Dirk rolled the head sideways, and the eyes were open and startled. Dirk lifted the short, thick club he carried in his right hand. It was wrapped in coarse brown hessian, but its weight and heft were obvious by the way he handled it. Mark tried to cry out, but his hoarse croak was lost in the roar of waters. Dirk struck his father across the temple, above the right ear, where the wet grey curls were plastered against the skull, and Mark seemed to feel the thud of the blow in his own soul. Then with one exploring forefinger, Dirk pressed the temple and felt the give of mortal damage, the grating of the rough edges of shattered bone shard deep in his father's head. Dirk's features were expressionless, cold and remote. But then he did something which seemed to Mark more dreadful, more shocking than the killing blow. With a tender touch of his fingertips, he closed the eyelids over Sean Courtney's dead, staring eyes. Then he went down on one knee and kissed his father's bloodied lips slightly, without a change of expression. It was the act of an unhinged mind. It was only at that moment that Mark realized that Dirk Courtney was insane. Almost immediately Dirk's manner changed, and his hands lost the gentle touch, becoming once again businesslike and precise. He rolled the body, unbuttoned the camel hair overcoat, and searched swiftly through Sean's clothing. Then he drew out a gold watch chain with the keys and gold hunter attached. He examined the keys briefly and then pushed them into his pocket. He stood and went to the rear door of the rolls and struggled with the handle. The door burst open at last, and Ruth Courtney's body spilled out sideways and lay at his feet. He took a handful of her thick, dark hair and drew her head back. Again he swung the short, thick club against her temple, and again he felt the skull like a doctor making his diagnosis, prodding to feel the soft spot of crushed bone. Satisfied, he lifted Ruth Courtney's limp, childlike body in his arms and carried her to the edge of the water. He dropped her over the side, and she was gone instantly, dashed away on the dark current down to where the plunging waterfalls would tumble her body into the Ladyburg Valley, and the cruel rocks would leave no doubt in a coroner's mind as to how she had died. Helpless with his injuries and exhaustion, his body battered and strained beyond its natural limits, Mark could not move, could hardly breathe, as he watched Dirk Courtney stoop and grasp his father's ankles. He dragged the general's heavy body to the edge of the torrent, straining backwards against the dead weight. Mark dropped his face into his hands and found that he was weeping, great racking, dry sobs that probed the injuries deep in his chest. When he looked up again, Sean Courtney's body was gone, and Dirk Courtney was coming towards where he lay, cautiously following the narrow ledge, searching the darkness with the lantern beam, sweeping the dark, tumbling waters, examining each foot of the ledge, looking for him, looking for Mark, knowing he had been in the rolls. The headlights of the truck had struck full into Mark's face in that fatal instant of collision. Dirk Courtney knew he was here, somewhere. Mark rolled onto his side and tried to unfasten the buttons of his coat, but in his haste he had tried with the right hand, and he whimpered with the pain. With his left hand now, he ripped the buttons away and struggled out of the garment, its wet folds resisting each movement, so that when at last he was free of it, Dirk Courtney was only 50 feet away, coming steadily, carefully along the ledge, the lantern in one hand, the short, heavy club dangling in the other. Lying on the edge of the river, Mark flipped the jacket sideways, trying to make it fall onto the rocks in the torrent below. But he had no time to see if he had succeeded. Dirk Courtney was too close. Mark rolled in towards the foot of the cliff, stifling the cry of pain, as his damaged ribs and broken wrist came in rude contact with the rock. In the lee of the cliff, there was a dark, shallow chimney, screened from the light of the headlights and lantern. Mark came to his feet. Dirk Courtney was out of sight beyond the angle of the cliff, but the beam of his lantern jumped and swept and swung, bobbing with each pace as he came on. Mark turned his face to the cliff, gathered himself, and found that some of his dissipated strength was returning, and his anger was still alive, like a small warm flame in his chest. He did not know if it was enough strength or anger to carry him through, but he began to climb slowly, clumsily. Like a maimed insect, he clung to the cold, wet rock and dragged himself upwards.